Hey, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast, where we examine the intersection between student learning and creativity. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a college professor. I'm a former middle school teacher. I'm a speaker, and I'm the author of the book Launch, which is all about creativity and design thinking and the way that it empowers students. And that connects to this current month's topic, which is how do we empower students and how do we incorporate student choice in a way that is meaningful? Today's episode seems to have nothing to do with student choice, not at first. It's inspired by another podcast I listen to called 99% Invisible, which is a great show if you ever get a chance to listen to it. And that reminded me of a book I'd read. It actually cited the book several times in this podcast, and it had me thinking about this concept of student choice and flexible design and the myth of the average and how this myth of the average pushes us toward standardization. So we're going to dive into all of that right now. Why science says the average student doesn't exist. So I have this cohort of 12 amazing future educators, although they each bring the same passion for kids and the same desire to teach. Each student brings a different personality, skill set, and mindset to the job. No two pre-service teachers are alike, and because of this distinct reality, their future students will benefit from this diversity. It's a good thing that all of my students are so different from one another. It would be lame and boring if they weren't. Now, I'm convinced that the more each student can teach out of his or her identity, the better it will be for his and her students. I think all students benefit from this diversity of perspective and personality. True, there are certain practices that work best and certain best practices that will benefit all students. That's true across the board. Still, this human diversity is critical for students. It's what makes relationships possible and student engagement work. It's why classrooms can be amazing communities where people know each other, and yet you can't simply duplicate that in the room across the hall. And it's easy to forget this simple truth that teaching is deeply human, and as a result, it is deeply diverse. I find it frustrating then that my students, my current graduate students, will have to pass a series of standardized tests in order to become certified. The massive transnational corporation called Pearson will decide whether or not my candidates know the content and the pedagogy well enough to work in a classroom. And here's how it works. The pre-service teachers first have to pass multiple choice tests, and then they follow the rigid guidelines of the EdTPA. This is where they submit lesson plans, videos, commentaries, assessments, reflections. It's a long, long ordeal. And they do this in order to prove to an evaluator that they don't know that they are fit to be a teacher. That's the system. And here's the thing. Although the test is supposed to be criterion referenced and based upon rubrics, their success, so each one of my students' success, will be determined by averages. So in a way, it's actually norm referenced. Pearson will use a bell curve, and they always do, to set the cut scores that will determine that my students are just high enough above average to become certified classroom teachers. Now, we take this for granted that averages are important, but what if the concept of average is fatally flawed? What if it simply doesn't work? What if there is no such thing as an average teacher? And what if in this push to create the average teacher, we are pushing away innovators and creative types who might have a different or even better way to approach teaching and learning? The problem with average. As mentioned before, I recently listened to a podcast from 99% Invisible. You can check it out on the show notes. It's awesome. I was sharing a story mentioned in The End of Average, which is a book that I highly recommend. Again, you can also find the link in the show notes as well. This notion of average is actually relatively new. Historically, it just didn't exist. And it actually emerged as a concept in the 1830s. It started when Adolf, I'm going to screw up his name, so there we go. An astronomer and mathematician used averages to, Kettle, I think is how you say it, determine the speed of movement of the planets. Now, he became obsessed with averages and actually coined the term the average man. And he got obsessed with this. He started measuring people, started figuring out what average is, and he was convinced that science would prove and math would prove that there is this universal ideal average man. As society shifted toward modernization, urbanization, and industrialization, they embraced this concept of average. It helped normalize messy data. It helped identify trends and standardize processes. And our current small, medium, and large clothing sizes, or extra large now, they have that too, are actually a throwback to this idea that began with the need to create averages in order to standardize military uniforms. In other words, all the way back then, they were starting to embrace this concept of average. Now, we live in a world that is obsessed with averages. We speak of average families, average incomes, and average prices. And unless you live in Lake Wobegon, where everyone is above average, most people think about average as just being normal, as being real, and as being something that should determine what we do. In fact, we still use this concept going all the way back from 1830s of the BMI. And we decide that somebody is overweight and obese and all kinds of things based on this flawed concept of average. And we take for granted the idea that average is accurate. But Todd Rose, in this book, The End of Average, suggests the opposite. He wrote, "Most of us know intuitively that a score on a personality test, a rank on standardized assessment, a grade point average, or a rating on a performance review doesn't reflect your or your child's or your students' or your employees' abilities. Yet the concept of average as a yardstick for measuring individuals has been so thoroughly ingrained in our minds that we rarely question it seriously. Social science researchers are beginning to discover the flaws in how we use averages to make decisions around design. There's a great story that illustrates this concept. Back in World War II, the U.S. faced a high mortality rate in their pilots. They just kept getting shot down left and right. And the U.S. assumed it was an issue of training or a failure to adjust to faster planes. They continued to explore every possible solution based upon these assumptions that there was something inherently wrong with the pilots. They weren't getting the right training, they were doing something wrong, but every tweak they made failed to make a dent in this problem. Eventually, they measured their pilots and concluded that nobody was average. So, I mean, they spent a lot of money and time and energy measuring 4,000 pilots, over 4,000 pilots, and they couldn't find a single man who fit this definition of average. And what they found was actually astounding to them. Few, if any, of the pilots were even close to the measurements of the average man. It turned out it was an illusion meant to make large, messy data seem simpler. It was a human invention, a common myth, a fabrication that society had accepted as scientific and as mathematical and as true, but they were beginning to realize that it simply wasn't true. There is no such thing as an average man. This revelation shocked the military. It turned out the problem wasn't with the pilots or the aircraft or even the training they had received. The real issue is that they were trying to fit diverse body types into a one-size-fits-all cockpit. And so they were stuck. They didn't know what to do. And then came the solution. It's actually kind of simple. Make things adjustable. Make the helmet straps adjustable. Make the pedals adjustable. Make the seats adjustable. Make everything adjustable. And it worked. The mortality rates plummeted as they embraced this idea called flexible design. They quit assuming that people needed to conform to the mythical idea of average. They started to change things, so they modified the system to fit the people instead of expecting the people to fit the system. Now, it's important to point this out, that averages aren't useless. However, they are often used to design systems and structures that are applied to all people. And that was the case with the pilots. And worse still, people use averages to try to assess the knowledge, skills, abilities, everything of specific individuals. And that's a problem. Again, here's how Todd Rose describes it. It's not that the average is never useful. Averages have their place if you're comparing two different types of people, like comparing the performance of Chilean pilots with French pilots, as opposed to comparing two individuals from each of those groups. Then the average can be useful. But the moment you need a pilot or a plumber or a doctor, the moment you need to teach this child or decide whether to hire that employee, the moment you need to make a decision about any individual, the average is useless. I think that's important. I think that's actually really, really critical that we understand that as educators. Too often, we take the same one-size-fits-all approach to education that the military used with the cockpits, and then we wonder why it's not working. Is it bad training? Is it flaws in the content? We aren't designing flexible systems, and that's the real problem. There is no average student. Schools are immersed in a system of averaging. Traditionally, we average out the scores on all assignments in order to produce a grade. We use a bell curve to average out student performance and set a curve for the entire class. We use standardized tests to judge students, teachers, and entire schools. And that's a problem. But often it's even more subtle. We use averages when we view research, often failing to pay attention to the nuanced differences in context from classroom to classroom. We use this idea of the average student when we make curricular decisions. What should the average student know? How long would it take the average student to learn this? How much work should the average student do on this particular project? What will the average student get out of class today? You see, it becomes this invisible thing that is powerful, that we use all the time, and we're failing to understand its implications on actual students. And here's the problem. The problem is none of our students are average. None of them. There is no such thing as an average student, just as there are no average pilots. However, when we aim for average, we find that instruction isn't actually fitting anyone. Take something as simple as timing. You give students 15 minutes on a task. That's the average. Some students are moving ahead, others are behind, and in this moment, average isn't working for anyone. Students are bored, angry, frustrated, disengaged, you name it. And that's a problem. And so there is no such thing as an average student. But if that's the case, why are we always using averages? Why are we focusing on this concept of average? And why are we still doing things like the small, medium, large version of the t-shirt and applying that to students as we differentiate? I think it's why it's important that we think about this concept of flexible design in the classroom. So, at first, the military assumed that their pilots were incompetent or poorly trained. However, when they shifted away from fitting the pilots into their design and started adapting their design to fit the individual pilots, everything changed. And I love this. I love the concept of flexible design. It's the idea that you create systems that are adjustable for the user. You could have a short, medium, and tall version of a seat in a car. Or you could make that seat adjustable and let the driver customize it to fit his or her needs. The first idea depends on averaging and differentiating. It's what schools do all the time when we use things like tracking and what we traditionally call differentiated instruction. But this second idea is different. It keeps things flexible and allows the user to make decisions about differentiation. This second one is flexible design. Now, what if our lessons, projects, units, and assignments were adjustable? What if our rules, procedures, and structures were flexible? What if students felt the permission to modify things on their own? As we design our classroom systems, especially at the beginning of the year, right now, it can help to ask, how could this be adjustable? What could students do in order to modify this to meet their own needs? Now, this isn't an end-all be-all list, but here are a few examples that I thought of. Getting rid of specific numbers on assignments, like 3 pages, 5 paragraphs, that kind of stuff, and shifting toward requiring quality work instead. I find that when students get into the habit of we are just going to write for this amount of time or read for this amount of time, and there isn't a specific number attached to it, they do a lot better. It also means allowing modifications on assignments, so setting up systems that let students make modifications. Creating loosely structured projects where students have more autonomy in what they are creating and how they're making it. De-emphasizing standardized tests and avoiding bell curves at all costs. Bell curves don't work, and they're proven that they don't work over and over and over again. But we still tend to buy into this in education. Letting students select particular strategies that work best for their own learning. Changing the pace up so that certain students can finish earlier and have enrichment, and others who are behind can have more time to work and not feel as though they are constantly having to catch up. This approach can feel nerve-wracking, both for students and for the teachers. It's why it can help to move incrementally toward more student choice and flexible design. This approach requires a deep sense of trust from the teacher. It can be hard to say, go ahead and modify it to fit your needs, because you might feel like they might take advantage of you. And sometimes they do. That's the risk you run. But I'm telling you, it's worth it when students feel empowered and begin to own their learning in a way that had never been imaginable before. This is, by the way, why I love design thinking. It's a flexible framework that allows students to own the entire process, from awareness through inquiry and into research, ideation, prototyping, and modifying. Eventually, it's what they do when they decide on who they're going to launch their work to. And it's essentially a shift into this flexible design, where students are in the driver's seat. Thank you for listening to The Creative Classroom. The music is from bensound.com. You can check it out. They have a pretty cool free Creative Commons music that you can add to projects and presentations. It's pretty awesome. Just want to say, if you enjoy this podcast at all, please leave a review on iTunes. That's a great way to show your love. Thanks a lot. Have a great day.